We are now continuing our look into the third essay in 1 Corinthians. This third essay deals with freedom and responsibility. And we're going to be looking at 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 19 through 27, which deal with the topic of full identification in mission. So, Paul began this essay as a response to a question from the Corinthian believers asking about food offered to idols. Can we or can we not participate in eating food offered to idols? And Paul responded to that in the first initial question by saying Christians must surrender personal rights for the sake of others. Then he goes on to give his own example. And Paul defended his apostolic authority and rights. He has a right to be supported, but he has given up that right. He has refused to exercise his rights. He refuses support so that only Christ can have a claim on him. And to illustrate the free nature of the gospel. Now he's going to discuss three ways in which Christians can or cannot identify with the world around them. First, he's going to talk about areas in which Christians can have full identification. The next section, he's going to talk about partial identification. And in the third part, he's going to talk about no identification. And we're going to be discussing the first of the three. Full identification. So this passage from verses 19 through 27 in chapter 9 is in two sections. Each is in ring composition form. The first part discusses how Paul himself has chosen to live, and in the second part, Paul explains why he chooses to live as he does. So this reads, "For though I am free from all, I have made myself a servant to all, that I might win more of them. To the Jews I became as a Jew in order to win Jews. To those under the law I became as one under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law I became as one outside the law, not being outside the law of God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those outside the law. To the weak, I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some. I do it all for the sake of the gospel, that I may share with them in its blessings. Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one receives the prize? So run that you may obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. So I do not run aimlessly. I do not box as one beating the air, but I discipline my body and keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified." So, how do you read it? What do you think Paul is communicating? How does this relate to the issue of food offered to idols? How does this relate to the issue of freedom and rights? What applications do you think might be derived from this passage, and what assumptions might we be reading into this passage?
He tries to be sympathetic or understand. Oh, I lost the word I wanted to use, but he tries to know the people he's dealing with.
Identify with each group of people he works with, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so in the issue of food to idols, he's trying to understand the people who would have trouble with it, exactly what their baggage is. You know, he's finding out that it could really wound them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And like eternally wound them, you know, to flaunt that.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is immaterial other than it's cheaper. Is it just the money of why you would eat it versus eating something else? I'm surprised because they were Jewish. Were they Jewish?
No.
Oh, so kosher wasn't an issue.
Kosher's
for
not
them.
An issue.
You know, I mean, for himself, kosher would be a huge issue of why he wouldn't eat it. It wasn't killed in a kosher manner.
Yeah, it would have been a huge issue for him prior to.
Yeah, okay. So he's trying to really identify the feelings and the reasoning in their minds, whatever it is, whether it's food to idols or, you know, whatever issue it is.
Do you have any problems with how Paul is approaching this?
Not personally. Not now, anyway.
He's very assertive.
What about the second half, where he talks about self-control and discipline and obtaining the prize and being disqualified?
Well, there's two things on it, and I read your little commentary at the bottom, which...
You're sneaking out.
Reading.
Myself, I don't read or I don't see it that way, but I can see other people reading this as just a flashy guy that he'll do whatever it takes to be in just by some means, so... Mm-hmm. He's this to that person, that to the other person, so he's nobody.
Okay.
But the one that bothers me personally is the very last sentence.
Yeah.
I did all this work. I worked hard, and now I'm disqualified.
What
do you think it means?
Well, I think it means that if he's just he's trying to get everybody else to do something right, but he's not going to do what's right.
Well,
he's not wanting to practice what he preaches. He just wants to tell others what to do. I think he's trying to practice what he preaches and not trying to just say, like we hear, yeah, I mean, obviously ministers preach things that you're like, you know, they're like, give everything to the church, and they're out golfing, you know. And you're like, well, you know, in my child mind, when I was hearing these things, I would think, you're not sacrificing anything, you know. My parents would never, ever have afforded that, or, you know, paying to go skiing, or we went sledding, you know. And it's not wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But in a child's mind, when they're saying, give all to the church, you know, and my parents already are giving more than they can afford to give, and they're out golfing or skiing, or you're just like,
okay,
where is that?
So anyone else, how else have you heard this passage, either section or both, preached?
Well, not how I heard it, but how I'm hearing it right now is Paul is saying, I'm going to be a legalist so that I don't offend, but by pretending to be a legalist, I hope that I don't really become one.
Okay.
We do it when in Rome, to us the Romans do. Yeah, he's very much in that mindset.
Okay.
But how would that disqualify him? I don't know.
Well, how have you heard... What does prize mean? Well, only one receives the prize.
Everybody runs. One receives a prize.
Well, I've heard the prize representative of salvation, even though not only one receives it.
I've heard it, but I don't like it because...
We need to get these out, see?
Yeah, yeah.
We need to get these thoughts out.
I'll just say, I'll take them out.
precepts.
Well, this is another phrase of Paul's.
Well, I'm going to get to that in just a couple minutes here.
Yeah, okay.
I just, before I tell you, I need you to tell me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the prize I've heard represented as salvation. The part about disqualified, I don't know.
Paul talk about work for your salvation?
Philippians.
Yeah. It sounds like a rephrase of that one.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that's enough for now. So the commentary here, the range of interpretations that have been suggested by commentators is remarkable. Moving from an understanding of Paul as being totally selfless, perhaps in a psychologically unhealthy manner, indicative of a loss of identity, to the contention that Paul was an opportunist in his dealings with potential converts. Careful reading of the text, however, indicates that such extreme interpretations are stereotyped, falling short of full comprehension of the subtlety of Paul's methods of mission and ministry.
Okay.
So I had some questions this week. Since, as we discussed in the previous part of this essay, gospel and grace are absolutely free. That's the scandalous, that's the offensive nature of the gospel and grace.
Mm-hmm.
Person can't merit it, and you can't return the favor.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we have discipleship and spiritual disciplines? Now, it's been explained as, well, see, we do those things to express gratitude for the gospel and grace. But then, why is discipline exhorted and commanded?
Well,
now, if it's gratitude, it should be a natural outflow.
Mm-hmm.
We would want to do those disciplines rather than having to be commanded.
The culture we live in today has changed from the culture of the 60s. In the 60s, you exercise in order to run the race, in order to win the race. Today, people are recognizing that the winning of the... We have group runs. Thousands of people are running. Nobody's running to win. They run to run. It's the journey is what the benefit, what the prize is in the journey, not who got the golden cup. And I think maybe Paul lived in that era where they were realizing that the exercise was the benefit, not the golden cup.
Probably not.
Okay.
Another reason that it's often given for discipleship and spiritual disciplines is so that we can draw closer to Jesus, to maintain a relationship with Him. Well,
yeah.
So if I don't do spiritual disciplines, then what happens? Why?
Exactly. Why?
Another reason that I've heard is so that I can test myself to see if I am really committed to Jesus and I'm really a follower.
You're tried in the fire and found wanting.
But what's
one day without eating and you're going to go.
So what's the
one
purpose?
Day with praying.
Another fourth reason is to be better equipped to witness and evangelize. Okay, so for whose benefit? My benefit? Or...
We should memorize verses so that in the end time we'll have it.
So, my dilemma was that none of the usual responses seemed to adequately address this question.
You weren't in a bad mood this week.
I was. So let's look at the first half in detail. Christmas, Easter, Halloween, All Hallows Eve, phrases like, by Jove, thank my lucky stars. They all have what in common?
Secular culture.
Pagan roots.
Uh-huh.
They all come from pagan mythology.
Ah, yeah.
So, should Christians identify with non-Christian culture, and if so, to what extent?
Well, I kind of think chicken and the egg. I think the Bible's full of that heritage.
Yeah.
Christians pick and choose.
Well, pick and choosing is what Paul is going to explain. How to pick and choose.
Yeah, he was pretty pick and choosy back then, yeah.
So he's going to explain which of these things on line A we should pick and choose.
Not necessarily.
No? He's not going to identify Christmas versus Easter?
No, because in his time he wouldn't have thought of, well, Christmas wouldn't have existed.
Halloween
wouldn't have existed. No, Easter, yeah, but it wouldn't have been called Easter.
You know, I didn't even know the word Easter was in the King James. They're just referring to...
But it's very much a modern interpretation, yes.
So, once again, this is... What we're discussing this week is the first of three parts dealing with Paul's response to the question, how can Christians identify with the world around them? So we're going to examine each one separately, but all three have to be considered together when we are seeking counsel on how to engage the culture. This essay is essential to the proper development of a theology for mission. And in this first half of this passage that we're dealing with this week, the topic of the law, the Torah, forms the center of this half. Now, this first half is actually a continuation of Paul's defense of Paul's apostolic position and authority. See, so this is from a commentary. But now he is concerned with what they would view as conduct too wishy-washy for an apostle. Mm-hmm. And especially for an apostle who would deny them the right to attend the cultic meals with their pagan friends. Indeed, Paul's own conduct delineated here could well have been used against him. Paul thus takes the occasion of this defense to explain his conduct, an explanation that rests solely on the cause of evangelism, not his right to do as he pleases.
Was Paul a complex person?
Quite.
Is that typical? Was he
he was the top of the class, basically, in Saul, you know. Well, Saul is the Hebrew, Paul is the Greek.
He was the top of the class as a Pharisee, and then the transformation added on to that with all this new thinking that he engaged in. He was a very smart person and a very complex person.
So we may have often heard about this passage, and that Paul said, to the Jews I became a Jew, and to the Gentiles I became a Gentile. But he never said that. What he did say is, I became a slave to all people. I became a Jew. For Jews I lived under the Torah. For Gentiles I lived outside the Torah. I became weak. I became all things to all people.
But he didn't say, I became a Gentile for the Gentiles.
Because Paul could not become a Gentile.
No, you can't.
One's lifestyle can be altered, but one's identity cannot be changed. Paul was a Jew.
Did he say, when in Rome, do as the Romans do?
I have no
idea.
Did
you hear Amy say it? She just gave me.
I don't think so, it's for me, but Paul, I think it's a paraphrase of Paul.
Paul cannot become a Gentile, but he can live as a Gentile. Kenneth Bailey makes an important point about cross-cultural ministry. Only when we are deeply rooted in our own culture can we risk reaching out across a cultural chasm to people on the other side. A bridge must be securely anchored at each end. Only then can the bridge be completed, and only then is travel across that bridge possible.
So in other words, Paul was so securely rooted in his Jewish heritage that he was able to step outside of it and still be secure.
There are cantilever bridges that have only one anchor on one side only.
Well, you have to be securely anchored to your own continent.
It says both sides. That's not true. One side
no,
is all
he wasn't
necessary.
Anchored to both sides. He was anchored.
They're very rare, and there's only a few.
So he was able to step outside of it.
Okay.
This is a metaphor. Metaphors do not apply
to reality.
Case in point. And so everything in the Bible shouldn't be applied to that scientific criteria.
But Paul is secure in who he is. He knows what makes a Jew a Jew. And that allows him to go outside. He knows that what he does not affect his Jewishness.
I think in a way I'm that way, but on the other hand, it seems like you're a little bit egotistical or high-handed to be aloof.
Part of his thing that seems that way to us, he's talking to a culture that we cannot identify with. He's talking to upper echelons that want to pay him. And they want to kind of own him because who pays owns.
Yeah.
And he won't be owned. And that's what his premise is, that he keeps
coming around. This is very much in the context of people wanting to claim him and put him in a box. Oh, by the way, when in Rome, St. Augustine, 390 A.D. When I go to Rome, I have some out of him. But here in Milan, I do not. Do you also follow the custom of whatever church you attend if you do not want to give or receive scandal?
That's the full quote.
St. Augustine, 390. Uh-huh.
When in Rome, he went on Saturday.
I went to Rome on Saturday.
And when in Europe,
Milan,
he did something else.
I do not. Yeah. And adapted to when in Rome, do as the Romans do. Which is also similar to how we interpret what Paul is saying, so we take it as being adapted from Paul.
So first, Paul is saying he is free from outside efforts to control his ministry.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Literally what Paul wrote in verse 19 is, for being free, I enslaved myself to all.
Uh-huh.
In his freedom, he is able to enslave himself. Here, Paul is explaining where his consistency lies. It's not in his outward behavior, but in his desire to gain the gospel a hearing by all. His mission is his consistency. And third, he is under no obligation to outside interests. He can go to the Jews or to the Gentiles, and neither group has grounds for restricting him. If he accepted support from one or the other, they would try to control his behavior.
Mm-hmm. And we certainly identify that with pagan ministers. They're restricted, no matter what is in their hearts. If they intend to keep a job, by that.
You're not going to go to the bank on Saturday.
And they don't go to the coffee shop or the truck stop.
So Paul is saying, no, I'm free, but I am free so that I can serve.
I like your bit of commentary here in the text about being a teammate to all. That makes sense. On page 2 where the text is written. Number B7.
Yeah, we're not there yet, though.
I know
we're not there yet. We passed by it way
back in the beginning, and I just saw the word teammate, and it made the whole thing kind of make sense.
Next, Paul declares his methods. With Jews, he didn't just act like one, he was a faithful Jew.
Yeah.
However, he could not be a Gentile, so he became weak.
Huh.
To put it in more contemporary terms, when he was among Jews, he was kosher. When he was among Gentiles, he was non-kosher, precisely because, as with circumcision, neither matter to God.
Yeah, but you can only be one or the other, not both.
But such conduct tends to matter a great deal to the religious on either side, so that inconsistency in such matters ranks among the greatest of evils. The difference, therefore, between...
Oh, I'm sorry, where are you?
In this box.
The box on...
Yeah.
I see.
The difference, therefore, between his own behavior and that of his social companions is not the behavior itself, which will be identical to the observer, but in the reasons for it. The latter abstain because they are under the law. It is a matter of religious obligation. Paul abstains because he loves those under the law and wants to win them to Christ. Despite appearances, the differences are as night and day. So there's, and then more on this becoming weak. Christians more often than not are very willing to serve the weak. And we want to serve those who are less privileged, those who are weak, those who are not Christians, those who are poor, etc.
Go out and find them in their squalor.
Those who are lost. We want to serve the lost. Most often this describes how we do missions. But it is a different thing to serve the weak versus becoming weak to win the weak. Paul's theology of mission is based on the theology of incarnation, following Jesus' pattern of entering into and identifying with humanity. Jesus emptied himself of his strength in order to identify with the weakness of humanity. Jesus' instructions to his disciples when they went out on mission was to take nothing with them, to become in need of those they sought to serve.
To be able to receive assistance from the people you are reaching out to. We don't tend to do that. When we go out for missions, we go to give and to instruct.
We go to as benefactors.
Yeah.
We have something to offer, and so we go out to give.
We need nothing.
Right.
We need zero.
So, D.T. Niles of Sri Lanka wrote, "To serve from a position of power is not true service, but beneficence. We run schools, hospitals, orphanages, agricultural farms, etc. But what we do not adequately realize is that these institutions are not only avenues of Christian service, but are also sources of secular strength. Because of them, we can offer patronage, control employment, and sometimes make money. The result is that the rest of the community learn to look on the church with jealousy, sometimes with fear, and sometimes even with suspicion."
Who's this D.J. Niles?
D.T. Niles? Someone in Sri Lanka.
Is this a nobody?
Or maybe a politician?
No, probably a Christian.
But you don't know what?
I don't know.
Someone in Sri Lanka who is addressing... the way
missions are run.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I certainly saw when I worked at Salvation Army, Karen Hofstad would always take down, before the limit of suitcases and stuff, take down lots of suitcases full of stuff to the people in Mexico where she had a huge resort. And she, but anytime you give, it has the connotation of giving you power.
Yeah.
Because you are giving, you know...
I'm claiming power over you. I am reaching down to you in your squalor and declaring myself to be better than you and more powerful than you. And, yeah...
The problem I see, it's real easy to point fingers and say that system of giving and service and missions is not good, therefore we do nothing.
No. How do you become weak?
So, Paul, what he is describing his methods is he is rejecting the position of strength in the theology of mission. He becomes weak.
Then that's part of the reason he doesn't accept a benefactor. He is not going in with the money.
He wants to
become simply part of the community.
Yeah.
Well, the rubber meets the road too harshly here because, as I mentioned to Lois this morning, we are having a class war right now in the United States.
Uh-huh.
The poor are wanting to have some of the goods that are on the platter, so, i.e. right now it's health insurance,
healthcare.
Uh-huh. Right, wrong, or indifferent is of none of my doing. I happen to have a job that provided health insurance, and I happen to carry through retirement, so I'm one of the haves.
Uh-huh.
And for me to go preach to the have-nots, which don't have it, is pretty high-handed. And if you read Paul, I need to give up my insurance in order to be able to even talk to him, because as long as I keep my insurance, I can't even talk to him.
You're a have, and they're a have-not.
And this blasted right smack in my face this week because I gloated. Because this gal called me to do another survey. Actually, I told you the other day, this guy came to my house and did a survey about health service, and he was okay. But she called to see if the surveyor did his job. So here we got a surveyor on top of a surveyor.
We've got you.
And they only want to survey you if you are under 30 years old.
But
so if you don't fit the demographic,
she asked,
you don't get the $30.
She asked if the guy came. I said yes. She said, are there two people in your household over 12 years old? I said yes. She said, can you tell me if they're male or female? And I said no. And from there it just went on downhill real fast. So finally I just blew up. I said, you know, this is getting ridiculous. I'm called more often than you can believe about surveyors doing surveys about this and that and everything underneath the sun. And I said, if half the people who are conducting these surveys would go out and get a real job, this world wouldn't be in the bad place it is right now.
Ooh, he was really up there.
And she said, thank you for your time, sir. Goodbye. And then I told it over to Dolores, and then later on I started realizing, you know, that wasn't very
understanding.
She probably doesn't have another opportunity for another job, and the fact that she's paying $3 an hour to make these telephone surveys, you know, I have unloaded on the have not and made her feel bad, and that's when I'm starting to realize, Paul, I can only talk from my power because I have it.
Huh.
I'm not very sympathetic for these people who don't. And I don't like it that they are infringing on my power. So,
ta-da!
I don't know what, I mean, am
it's
I...
It's a realization that that's the case.
I am being a tyrant.
Well, and
yeah, that is really the thing. We don't realize.
I'm just like the aristocratic of England.
We don't realize our attitudes and our beliefs.
All our preconceptions.
Until it's pointed out to us.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't get. Okay, if I was in Old England, I can't get up my dukemanship. I can't just walk away from. Mm-hmm.
Or you could.
So am I supposed to walk away from my insurance? I've worked 30 years for that retirement.
I don't think so. I don't think that's one of the necessary things.
And then you could try to get online and get Obamacare that nobody else can get.
Different people can talk in different ways to different people.
But, okay, if I was in England, should I give up my dukemanship and go get a real job?
Well, you could be kind to the people that are under you instead of tyrant. Like Lord Fauntleroy.
The problem is, I'm saying dukemanship because usually those people are
privilege.
The privilege. Are two or three generations removed from anybody who really did any work. So we have a pretty poor esteem of those people.
So some of us do have a different kind of social privilege, but we still have social privilege.
I am.
Are we supposed to give up the social privilege that we have,
Paul,
in order to talk with...
See, Paul didn't necessarily give up all his social privileges. He was he had pride in his Roman citizenship, and he used it when it was to his benefit. Uh-huh. You know, so that's not something most everyone in the empire could claim.
He was unusual.
He was unusual in that regard.
But if we do run schools, hospitals, orphanages, agriculture farms for benefit. We really do.
What if we went to another country? We lived as a part of the community.
So, I spent some time in Singapore.
Yes. Not this last week while studying for this lesson.
No, but back then when the General Conference had the Far Eastern Division, now it's something different. Uh-huh. But the headquarters was located in Singapore. It was basically a nice compound of estate, a bunch of these large houses. The expats were all isolated, essentially.
Uh-huh. The Americans come to Singapore to work at the compound.
Yeah.
The fancy compound.
And they would hire local maids, gardeners, to work for them, which is a traditional practice there.
Yeah.
Well, and if you didn't hire anybody else, it would be considered wrong because you're keeping all the wealth to yourself.
But at the same time, although they were following traditional practice, they were trying to serve from a position of strength.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're not paying them a high wage. They're paying them the lowest that they'll accept, too.
Same with those people who worked in the Southeast Asia Union mission. There was a separate compound. Not quite as nice as the division compound.
They lived separately from the community around them.
But that's my sister was in Africa. They didn't have a compound, but every 6 years they were paid to go back to the United States, and a lot of their income was actually put in escrow in the United States. So you live, but you don't live. You live two different lives. But here I am standing in the same box because I'm living my life of prestige and power. I think it's fair because I got here culturally in an acceptable manner. Back then, the Duke thought he got there culturally in an acceptable manner. We are blind to our blindness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's part of the gospel. The gospel is to challenge these.
Well, I'm not going to be snotty to any more servants.
Snotty.
But what I told her, I thought was pretty mean, and later on I felt guilty about it. I really did. I don't think that was nice.
God is weaseling into your heart.
So Paul explains in the center where he talks about the law, Paul explains his actions and some caveats. Paul has no problems with conforming to Torah, as long as it is not claimed as a means to obtain God's favor, or to obtain a right standing, righteousness with him. As long as it is simply a matter of cultural practice and tradition, Paul has no problem with sacrificing, with vows, with the laws of kosher laws, with law purity laws, etc., etc.
Yes, but he is being perceived by the legalist as being a legalist. Now, Paul isn't. But he perceives one.
Well, you know what? Always.
But to do otherwise would be to cause an offense. That's an unnecessary offense.
There will always be people that judge you no matter what you do. They're even judging him when they don't have anything to judge him with. They want to attach strings to him, and so they're judging him. And he's like, no strings.
Paul then explains, living outside of the Torah is not the same as living without God's law.
That I have to really believe.
The Torah is not God's law.
Oh, don't say that real loud either.
Well, yeah, but the Ten Commandments.
God's law is love.
Yeah. So we don't, in our modern mindset, with our theological history, we don't like that. You know, we think that the Ten Commandments in particular are special. But for Paul, the distinction between Ten Commandments and the rest of the Torah didn't come about until about, what was it, year 1000, 1080.
So for, trying to decide which laws we have to follow, because we can't be without law. But obviously these other laws are outdated. So which laws? That makes sense.
So for Paul, then, what is God's law? He doesn't state explicitly what it is in this passage, but from reading the rest of the letter, we get the idea that God's law is the mind of Christ. The law of Christ is the mind of Christ. It comes from chapter 2, verse 16. And what is this law? It is probably love. 1 Corinthians 12:31 through 14:1, you know, chapter 13, essentially, with the one verse, last verse of 12 and first verse of 14 included.
If you chose to take a vote right now of meeting on Sunday instead of Saturday or Wednesday, I don't care, I would vote against it. And I probably would continue to meet on Saturday. But I don't think it's obligatory. I think I have the freedom to choose.
It's a cultural practice.
And I don't judge. Uh-huh. But the odd thing is, there will be a lot who do judge.
Yes.
If I do or don't.
Right.
But
the church in which we were raised very much judged the day you worship as a mandatory law.
Right.
And that you have to keep in order to have God's favor.
There are many people out there that if you choose to meet on Sunday is sending a message that I'm not sure that would be constructive.
Right.
But on one hand, that's not my problem. But on the other hand,
it is your problem.
I have the freedom to choose to go on Saturday or not. I don't have to exercise that freedom.
You also have the freedom to go on Sunday, and you do not have to exercise that freedom either.
I don't have that.
He has the freedom to sleep in at Point Baker.
Yeah, but I'm called a jackass when I go do something, too.
Did he actually call you a jackass?
Yeah, two or three times. He's told her what I can and can't do. And he used those words, yes.
Because Adventists are defined by obeying certain rules.
And I'm not conforming to what his...
Yeah. So Paul, through these essays, he's building toward chapter 13. He is building a case for what really ought to be the controlling axis in our lives.
Uh-huh.
See, it's not outward behavior. Our outward behaviors have to adapt uniquely to every situation that we encounter. But that adaptation is based on the principle of love.
But love is kind. Love
forbearing.
Which love looks like.
And so
in other words, 1 Corinthians 13 is the law of God.
Probably.
As opposed to Exodus 20.
1 Corinthians 13
is the love chapter. Love
is kind. Love is not puffed up. Love does not boast.
Oh, I have thought recently, if you take everything out of the Bible except what Jesus actually said himself in person on earth, not what he said to have said, it's love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we have put flesh and blood on that word, it's love, and he hasn't refuted us. Therefore, by him not refusing us or refuting it, we've assumed he said it. And that's not the case.
Now we get the second part, where Paul talks about discipline. The center of this chiastic structure is the pair discipline and prize. The Isthmian Games took place every 2 years. That's
so
the
what kind of game?
Isthmian.
Okay.
Remember that Corinth.
Like Olympics?
The Corinth was located on the Isthmus.
Oh, I see. The game's on the Isthmus.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so the Corinthians were familiar with athletes, athletic events, and the preparations.
Uh-huh.
Tents were needed to house all the visitors, so that would have kept Paul, Priscilla, and Aquila busy. Was a good place for tent makers.
You want a campground?
So Petersburg is the center of wrestling and boxing of the world. And we make our livelihood off making tents to support this ungodly sport of wrestling and boxing. Oh, mercy.
So the outer pair of this essay, Paul talks about the gospel preaching. So what is Paul's intent here by the phrase, the gospel? Gordon Fee writes, by the gospel, this phrase, Paul is not referring to its content as such, but to the proclaimed gospel as God's saving power at work in the world. Thus he means, for the sake of the progress of the gospel. Paul is talking about the process of proclaiming the gospel rather than the content of the gospel in this essay. 23b reads, that I may share with them in its blessings, in the English Standard Version and probably most other English translations. Alternately, it can be read, that a partner of it I may become. The word blessings does not appear in the Greek. So in this passage, Paul is saying, well, the progress of the gospel is already taking place, apart from any human effort. Paul is writing that he wants to become a partner of the gospel work that is already going on. Paul does not argue that he must become all things to all people so that the gospel can receive a hearing and be accepted. For him, God, through the gospel, was already at work across cultural lines, and he wanted to become its partner. The gospel train was moving, and he could jump on or get left behind. So, what about being disqualified? Typically, this is interpreted to mean not saved or to be lost. But is that the best interpretation? Nowhere in this passage does Paul write of his own personal salvation. He writes only of the salvation of others. This passage is dealing with fitness for performing mission work. Thus, this disqualification probably has nothing to do with personal salvation and everything to do with whether or not one is prepared for mission work.
So, Mike, when he is living in a different way, when he's living with one category of people, he still keeps himself fit for mission to another category of people, so he's not disqualified for membership in that.
Could be. That could be. So, you know, mission, not salvation, is the subject of this passage. The context is everything.
Why does he have that quote then of, lest I be disqualified?
Lest I be disqualified for serving the Jews, for instance.
Some people just ain't got it, and so it's probably best not to send them on mission.
Well, if he... while he was serving the Gentiles, if he let himself go so that when he returned to the Jews, he was not able to resume the lifestyle of the Jewish culture, then he would be disqualified for serving the Jews.
Close, but not quite. What he's saying is, you know, it's okay if you're rigid, and some people are less rigid. If you're rigid, you might not be the right personality to take on this mission of different cultures.
Okay.
Nothing wrong with that. It's just some people have a different
adaptability.
Yeah.
To adapt might be disqualified for serving different kinds of cultures back and forth.
Exactly. But you're still qualified and saved and all the rest. It's just that your adaptability may not be your forte.
So when we see mission as the underlying theme of this passage, the rest of this passage actually clears up rather nicely. So in the rest of this second half of the passage, Paul uses sports, athletic metaphors.
Like a preacher using a football.
Yeah. This is a metaphor. Don't press details too literally. You know, like only one wins the race, only one receives the prize. Don't press that detail too literally. Paul's using an example. What he is saying is mission work is hard work. Preparing for it and performing it both take tremendous discipline and energy. This is what Kenneth Bailey writes.
Comparable to...
With the Isthmian Games sponsored by the city of Corinth, the citizens of that city could not help being fully aware of the time commitments and energy required to compete in those games. Paul builds on that awareness and tells his readers that the same level of discipline is required to cross cultural lines in the name of Christ. Paul is not talking about ascetic disciplines. He is discussing the high commitment required if one is to successfully cross cultural barriers in the name of Christ. He is discussing mission. He warns his readers that the task of all things to all people takes enormous energy. He is discussing the cost of cross-cultural incarnational mission. Language, culture, history, art, literature, politics, worldview, music, civil unrest, and war all must be experienced, comprehended, and embraced if one is to effectively enter into another culture.
And that's why you can tell us about things because you learn about the cultures of when it was written and, you know, like, Who was it to? Who? What did they hear? What did the person intend them to hear? You know, blah, blah, blah. And that's why you can preach at other churches and not... You can inspire them without offending them. Uh-huh. Because you study. It takes a lot of energy and a lot of work.
Well, and if you're going to serve in a culture other than your own... It makes sense to fully participate in the entirety of the culture rather than just bringing your own culture in and imposing it on the people around you. Huh.
The prize here is not salvation.
Uh-huh.
In spite of everything you may have heard in the past.
And the disqualification.
The prize is the opportunity and privilege of becoming partners with the gospel mission and the fruit of mission work, the salvation of as many as possible.
The prize is becoming part of the team.
Yeah. So when this passage is read with the underlying assumption that prize is salvation, we end up with a host of problems, such as works-based salvation. I might lose my salvation if I don't discipline myself enough. Or loss of assurance and increase in guilt. You know, how much discipline is enough? Or inappropriate asceticism. You know, the more I sacrifice and beat myself up, the better. Or coercive methods. Authority figures dictating what appropriate discipleship is, what it looks like, and parishioners conditioned to accept these beratings for not living up to ideals. So we go back to the dilemma that I had this week.
dilemma.
Discipleship and spiritual disciplines aren't about me. It's not spiritual self-improvement. It's not spiritual self-help to express gratitude or to keep in Jesus' good graces or to prove that I really belong or even to be a better evangelist and a witness, at least not in the usual way of thinking about it. Spiritual disciplines are about learning and finding ways to partner with God's Spirit in the work of the gospel that is already happening. Spiritual disciplines are less about an individual's personal spiritual condition and more about how to benefit others. And this is something that Jerry touched on a few minutes ago. You don't have to participate. You can be a spectator. Because it's not your salvation that is at issue here. But you might lose out on the possibility of greater joy and satisfaction of going beyond the minimum goal.
That's the point. You can enjoy watching a baseball game. And if you're 84 years old, it's probably a lot of fun. But if you're 16, you probably would enjoy playing it.
And watching it is not the most enjoyable way of participating.
It's not wrong, but why not have some more fun?
And spiritual disciplines include far more than just the usual prayer, Bible study, church attendance, fasting, whatever, etc. The traditional spiritual disciplines. The stuff that you're supposed to do as a Christian. It can and should include learning about things like anthropology, psychology, sociology, history, literature, music, arts, language, mythology, science, pop culture, etc., etc.
Two jazz concerts is a spiritual discipline?
It can be. Anything that will help you integrate better and understand the people that you're trying to minister to better.
That's why we went to the concert.
That's right.
Where the walls were vibrating.
And if you're going to go there to judge, don't go.
Yeah.
No. No. I'm not judging. But in order to...
If you're spying, don't go.
No. But in order to learn about the culture you're in, and immerse yourself and become part of it.
Not just learn, you have to participate in it.
We actually
immerse yourself in the culture.
You know, they had times when there was no music and there was talking. And the music was loud, mm-hmm. but testimonies? Mm-hmm. The testimonies were huge. Mm-hmm. They loved God, mm-hmm. you know, and... Mm-hmm.
Well,
it was very apparent.
As far as music, to me, music is... Well, later.
It was funny because, you know, they just hand out the earplugs to you.
So, now that we have discussed this, how do you read this passage now? How might it change the way you approach missions and evangelism?
Well, I have to ask a question before I can answer you. Missions and evangelism. What are you missioning? What are you evangelizing? What's the product?
And who's the target?
Target.
Bingo. That's like, I went to Jennifer and I'm like, I worked an half-hour overtime, shoot me now. And she's like, cow.
The target to be assaulted with God.
What is the God? We keep coming back to that again and again and again.
I think the gospel is the same as love. It's love. There's...
meeting people's needs.
Well, the gospel is... there is a God who loves you, but I think more basic than that, the gospel is simply love.
I think you have to be rooted in that you are safe in Jesus' love no matter what.
Well,
and as that root grows deep,
who is you?
You will have...
You're the person who is conducting missions.
Yourself.
So you want to give them... You're trying to give... the gospel to a third party.
What are you giving the third party?
Love.
You're giving your love, but what is that party supposed to... Do you see what I'm trying to ask?
And then what
you are a vehicle.
If your mission is successful, what is it that the target does respond?
What is common across all cultures is fear.
That's kind of where I'm trying to go.
Yeah.
Especially the fear of death.
Well, so
mythologies basically form around that subject.
Right.
Freedom from fear.
Now you said
First John, the author there writes that perfect love casts out fear.
So, and that's what I've been thinking it is. The true gospel is giving people, giving them hope and walking away from fear. And as far as changing lifestyles and changing doctrines and changing beliefs, it really is nothing. Those things are only, if you want to enjoy them, there's something to, you know, if you want to play baseball, fine. If you want to sit in the bleachers, fine. But the point is, you're not doing anything out of fear, ever. Ever.
So the gospel is love, hope, freedom from fear. And the mission of a missionary is to partner with God, with the Holy Spirit, to help the world around us experience love, hope, and freedom from fear. And they may choose to join us in the belief and the mission, but that comes from God. But the goal is to help the people around us experience love, hope, freedom from fear.
Well, I can love another person, and I can give them love and acceptance, but I can't really give them love that they have. I can give them love that I have, but I can give them freedom from fear. So it seems like what I'm giving them is freedom of fear, and what they do with it is up to them. But is that the message of God loves you and freedom of fear?
Amy, what is it with these benches? The wood. It's like something.
Well, Paul, in this letter, in chapter 13, is going to write faith, hope, and love. Those are like the most. That's the most important thing.
Faith, hope, and love.
And but the most important of the three is love.
Could freedom from fear be equated to faith
or hope?
Well, we're talking about. I guess I don't know how to express myself, but something you have and you can share, but you can't give what some things, and they have to develop their own. I can have love, faith, hope, and I can hopefully encourage them to develop their own faith, hope, and love. But it's
the reason for many, for pretty much every religion, actually I would say every religion, is death is controlling.
Fear.
Death is the controlling thing. And what Christianity, the gospel ought to offer, is freedom from the fear, freedom of death controlling you through fear.
And Paul was so adamant that we don't take out fear and then replace it with another fear or a different fear or another obligation, another. Take it out and stop.
One of the themes throughout this letter so far we've seen is that the Corinthians have a completely warped idea of what Christian freedom means. Paul is trying to get them back to true freedom that is found through the cross and through the resurrection. The cross and the resurrection represents both God, what love looks like, and also freedom from death. Now, death could not hold Jesus in the grave.
And I don't know how to answer your friend's question about why aren't we being healed today? But I think the answer is exactly what he's saying. We are released from fear of death.
We may physically die. But that doesn't... That's not the end. We don't have to fear death. Because there is something beyond physical death.